Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm super annoyed because we have somebody on discussing probably second to D.B. Cooper, the most annoying mystery society has to offer. But, you know, I'll sit through it. We'll get through it. Everyone together, we'll get through it. Tim, you're super excited, so I guess I don't need to ask you how you're doing, but I will. How are you doing?
I am doing great. I knew you hated Mothman.
I hate Mothman.
I forget where I called you out on that. I don't know if it was Crime and Culture Live or in this episode.
It's in this episode and probably Crime and Culture Live. I think you called me out at our live panel at CrimeCon too about it. I just out of the blue, just randomly.
Well, you do hate Mothman, but I love it, Lance.
You love it.
And this is sort of a new twist on Mothman, of course.
That's what we needed.
Well, most people know Mothman from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, or the John Keel book, or the Richard Gere movie that was okay. The book was good, kind of a little weird too, but obviously. But, you know, I love cryptids, Lance, and I can't help it. The new twist here is that the Mothman has recently been seen around Chicago and Lake Michigan. And our guest today, Tobias Wayland, wrote a book called The Lake Michigan Mothman. And I read it, and there's a bunch of eyewitness sightings from Chicago and the Lake Michigan area in 2017. And really, you know, it turns out the sightings of Mothman or this winged creature really never stopped. I am fascinated by it. I'll admit it. I love it, actually. I even watched the documentary that Tobias is in that is called On the Trail of the Lake Michigan Mothman, and that was pretty fun, too.
And while I do present a very convincing case about my dislike of the Mothman, I'm just playing around. I do enjoy...
No, you hate it.
I do enjoy the mysticism of the Mothman. I do enjoy the cryptids as well. And it's hard to not enjoy a conversation with Tobias Wayland. He is very passionate about what he does. Himself and his wife, Emily Wayland, they run an organization called the Singular Fortean Society. You can check out everything that goes on there at Singular Fortean. That is Singular FORTEAN.com. And you can see all the work that they do. Very, very cool stuff. He also has another book called Strange Tales of the Impossible. And I highly recommend that as well.
All right, everybody, check out the links in the show notes. Thanks a lot for listening. We're going to break quick for commercial here, and then we'll be right back with Tobias Wayland and the Lake Michigan Mothman.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Rex Hurlman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer Podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Hurlman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Hurlman. Initially charged with 3 murders, Hurlman is now officially charged with all 4 deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Hurlman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISK podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to Seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
Welcome to the podcast, Tobias Wayland. How are you today?
Good. Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's really a delight to have you on. Tim introduced me to your work. It's fascinating. I don't know these things that you talk about. Things like this have never happened to me directly, so I always end up kind of leaning on the side of like, I need like the physical, tangible evidence, and I can't wait for this conversation because I feel like if anyone can sway me, it'll be you. And before we get into it, can you introduce yourself and introduce us to your organization, the Singular Fortean Society?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. So my name, of course, is Tobias Wayland, and I am the writer and editor for the Singular Fortean Society. So what that is a journalistic and investigative organization that my wife and I started back in 2016. And so my wife, Emily, who's also, of course, my partner in the Singular Fortean Society, she does a lot of the design work. But in addition to that, she does a lot of the photo and video examination. You know, so she's a lot more qualified to look at like photographs and things and sort of pick them apart because she actually has a degree in photography. She uses it a lot professionally. So in addition to being a fantastic wife, she's been a great partner, you know, for the Singular Fortean Society too. Honestly, I like to tell people that she's sort of the reason that I'm not just some crazy person standing in like green text on a black background somewhere on the internet. Like if you see our website, you go, wow, that's a nice looking website. That's completely her fault. I didn't have anything at all to do with that. A little bit about what we do is not necessarily specialize in any one area because we're sort of interested in the entire breadth of unusual phenomena. And that comes from that word Fortean, which is right there in our name. That's actually based off of the name Charles Fort. And so Charles Fort was an early 20th century collector of weird news stories. So he would collect all of these weird news stories from all over the world. And he would compile them in these massive volumes, speculate often very tongue-in-cheek as to the nature of these phenomena and sort of find commonalities and things. And in fact, one of the quotes for which he is most famous is, one measures a circle beginning anywhere. And so I've always sort of taken that to mean that, you know, by studying any aspect of the paranormal, you can understand something about all of it. You can learn something about alien abduction, for instance, by studying parapsychology or ghosts and hauntings or even cryptids. So that's the approach we take. And then as far as how we deliver it, we try to remain as objective as possible. So you won't often hear me say, you know, oh, this person saw this thing. You know, I'll say, well, this person said they saw this thing. We use a lot of words like reportedly, much like yourself, you know, we can't be sure of what it was exactly that somebody saw. And so to my mind, the only ethical way that we can relate a story like that is by saying, hey, this is what this person says their experience was. And that's not to take away anything from them, frankly. Like that's not meant to be insulting to whomever we're speaking with. It's just meant to be as honest as possible about what we're reporting on, you know? And so the society aspect, of course, comes from us wanting it not to be about us. Like, it's not just my opinion on things, you know? Like, I actually leave my opinion out of every article. You know, if you actually want my opinion on stuff, you've either got to read one of my books or listen to me on a podcast or something. From the very beginning, we didn't want it to be just about, you know, our specific view, because we think everybody's view is important and has value. And so when we were coming up with what we wanted to do in terms of our organization, we felt very strongly that we wanted to make them as inclusive as possible.
And how does one meet their life partner and have it be such a perfect union where you're able to confidently say, hey, can you work with me on this? And then beyond that, can you be a part of the society, like a co-founder? Was it something that just naturally came to the two of you?
Boy, like how do you get to that point? Trial and error of a whole lot of that, honestly. Well, you know, I was at a point in my life where, you know, I was dating again. And, you know, obviously I was into all of this weird stuff. I didn't want that to be a point of contention with any woman that I was, you know, going to try to seriously date. And so I was very upfront about it. you know, like I was dating and, you know, I would be online on, you know, online dating sites and stuff. It'd be like, look, I'm into all this weird stuff. If you're not cool with me, you know, like wanting to go out and investigate ghosts or UFOs or whatever, then like just right off the bat, you should know because it's just not going to work out. And so Emily already knew by the time that we had our first date that I was interested in this stuff. While she wasn't super interested in it prior to us meeting, like it was something that had been on her radar. And interestingly enough, she had actually told me on our very first date, you know, over drink, she told me about this Fortean phenomenon that I had never heard of, but it was the Paulding light. So up in the UP, so way up north in Wisconsin, you can cross over to the border into Michigan on that little peninsula there. And there is this ghost light. It's called the Paulding light, and it appears fairly regularly. And what it probably is, you know, headlights reflecting, you know, from this highway. But it looks really cool, and all kinds of folklore and such has sort of like arisen around this phenomenon. And so I was immediately impressed. And so I think right there, you know, in that moment, I was just like, wow, you know, like this, I think this is going to work out. Oh boy, almost 7 years later, you know, we're still together.
Sounds like she did her homework. I just love that story. Great story.
Thanks.
Your site, singularfortean.com, you post articles several per month about odd things that come into the site?
It's a mix of things that are reported to us directly and things that I see in the news. You know, I try to get, you know, maybe 2 to 3 articles per week. But one thing that I don't want to do, and this is something else I've really been very firm about, is, you know, sacrifice quality for quantity. You know, you see some websites out there and they're probably, you know, just bots that troll for certain keywords. And then, you know, you can even get them to like write little summaries of articles and stuff. And so you get just every dumb thing that exists on the internet is sort of all treated equally. And I didn't want that because frankly, there isn't that much interesting stuff happening in the world of the paranormal at any one time. And so something that I wanted to do was only cover those things that I think people with an honest interest in this field would really, really find of any value. And so, you know, we work to do articles just at that level. And so, you know, we'll have stuff that is reported to us. And then usually, that'll lead to like some kind of preliminary interview. And sometimes that's as far as it goes, frankly. You know, sometimes if the event in question happened years ago, you know, I might speak to somebody over the telephone and sort of get their full testimony that way. And other times, you know, we're able to actually get out to the actual location where the experience happened. And, you know, every once in a while, somebody is actually willing to take us around the area and show us all of the details and stuff. And so when that happens, you know, I try to include everything that I reasonably can, because again, you know, sort of open and honest investigation is something that's very important to us. So I don't want to hide anything behind layers of obfuscation. I don't want to misrepresent anything. I very much just want people to know everything that I can tell them. And when I say everything that we can, you know, there are people who insist on anonymity, and I understand that. I get why they do it, and I never pressure anybody to go on the record if they're not comfortable doing that. I appreciate it whenever somebody is willing to, because it really, really helps. It really adds a layer of credibility that I think is missing for some people who don't want to read anonymous reports. But our hope is being consistently open and honest about our investigations and reporting on them as objectively as possible, that will lend us some credibility that witnesses can borrow then if they want to be anonymous. So I can say, well, look, you know, like this person, you know, isn't comfortable with their name getting out there because they said they saw a monster or something, and they're worried that the people in their community are going to make fun of them, which is frankly perfectly valid. Because they might, you know, you've seen what we do and you've seen how we do things. So I think it's not unfair to ask people to just take my word that this person, you know, reported what they did. And then the other thing, you know, as opposed to that sort of personal investigation is covering like popular news stories, because one of the things that sort of shaped the direction that we ended up going in was seeing how mainstream news sources tended to treat paranormal experiences. They're not often taken very seriously. There isn't a lot of due diligence paid, frankly. The standard of journalistic ethics is somewhat lax. I mean, they're just not covered with the same seriousness that other stories are. And so I thought we could do better. You know, we could actually try to follow up on things and use our own experience and our own knowledge, at least of the lore surrounding these subjects, too, because you don't see enough of that in the media. They might have somebody with a degree in some scientific field that works for them to cover science stories. You know what I mean? They don't have that for weird stories. They just don't. I thought that was something that we could do. And I like to think that we do it pretty well. And I think it's especially relevant when you see hoaxes being passed off as something that is legitimate. And you'll often see that as much from what you would consider a mainstream credible news source as you will anybody else, because if they get a weird photograph or, you know, video or something, like, they're not really going to look into it. They're going to post it, you know, as part of their crank file or whatever and say, hey guys, let's all laugh at this for a minute and then just move on. But I will take the time to actually dig into it and try to see what it's about and if we can actually learn something more about it than has necessarily already been presented. And it's not just mainstream news who does that. I don't want to just crap all over them because there's a lot of good, you know, journalists and reporting that does happen. You see the same kind of stuff with a lot of other paranormal websites or organizations, things like that, where a lot of people just will do anything for clicks and they're not super interested necessarily in informing people, which is really too bad. And so, you know, you just get a lot of, you know, viral nonsense endlessly regurgitated across the internet, unless somebody does something about it.
Yeah, that New York Times report about the UAPs from the Navy pilots, that is I think a great direction to go in. I think that's kind of what you're talking about. Not enough credible articles like that.
Absolutely. Like, that is an excellent example of where I would like to see reporting on these subjects go, because it's so well researched. You know, there are legitimate, credible sources, and it's a story that has evolved since then. That if people aren't following it, they should definitely be following it, because it really is fascinating. And it might not lead us to aliens or interdimensional beings or whatever else. Really, like, this rabbit hole at least gives us valuable insight into the nature of sort of off the books government like programs and how, like, the different ways that they have obfuscated them, like how they're treated, even just like the compartmentalization of the government itself and how different agencies don't communicate. And so they have no idea what other people are doing. Any civic-minded person should want to follow this story just for the things they can learn about how our own government, like, operates. You know, it's really interesting.
You've written a couple of books, and one of them I've got here in my hand. It's called The Lake Michigan Mothman: High Strangeness in the Midwest. I think the Mothman topic is really interesting. I've been interested probably since I saw the trailer for The Mothman Prophecy and understood what that was and then did some research. Tell us a little bit about your book and why you decided to write it.
The impetus behind Lake Michigan Mothman: High Strangeness in the Midwest was that this was an investigation that we had been a part of for several years at that point. And so to go back to the very beginning, at least for us, it was the spring of 2017. We'd really only been operating for, you know, a handful of months at that point. I saw this article about sighting reports that had been sent in to MUFON, which is the Mutual UFO Network, for anybody not familiar. This trio of winged monster sightings had been sent in to MUFON, and they had published a short article about it to their website. And you could read the case reports from their CMS online, you know, basically just describe this large winged creature. The reports sort of variably described it as bat-like or owl-like. There wasn't a lot of follow-up. It wasn't necessarily for lack of trying. I know Sam Maranto. He's the state director for MUFON in Illinois. And, you know, he had told me that they had tried to reach out to these witnesses, and, like, they had very limited email communication and weren't, like, ever able to follow up with them. I thought that you know, I would write a short article about these like specific reports, and I'd add a little context about similarities, you know, between other like winged humanoid sightings, like in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, of course. And I really thought that was going to be the absolute end of it. I thought it was going to be some weird one-off sightings, and like that would just be it, and we'd never hear about it again. That's not what happened. Of course. Next thing I know, you've got sightings coming in seemingly constantly. And they were coming in to people like Lon Strickler over at Phantoms and Monsters and Manuel Navarrete over at UFO Clearinghouse. And I reached out to both of them for interviews that summer, so summer of 2017. And they both agreed to be interviewed. And I found them to be, you know, relatively forthright in terms of, you know, answering my questions, and they didn't really seem like they were pushing any agenda. They were speculative in their reasoning, but I think that's fair because none of us really have an idea, like any idea what's going on. It wasn't too long after that because of our, you know, relative proximity to Chicago, that we were actually asked to help with the investigation. And so we were getting our own reports at that point. Like people would reach out to us directly. And so, you know, there were just dozens and dozens of reports coming in. I know at this point, geez, in 2022, we've got to be well over 100. I mean, I honestly haven't counted in some time. At the time that I wrote this book, there was a lot of misinformation about these sightings that I saw being spread on the internet. And of course, the internet being sort of the best and worst thing to simultaneously to happen to this field ever. Because of all of the misinformation, and if you're at all familiar with the paranormal field, you'll know that there's a lot of big egos here and a lot of people who want to get famous, and they'll sort of do anything to achieve that goal, up to and including lying about people and spreading misinformation. And so what I wanted to do was get all of the sightings and everything that had gone into investigating them up until that point, and just get it all out where everybody could see it. You could pick up the book. Everything was in there and available for people as sort of one definitive source. And so they didn't have to rely on trying to find, you know, however many dozens of articles that I had written already, and then put all of them together and try to make sense of it.
You had mentioned the internet. So there's one way that you do your investigations, but also on Twitter, I was just scrolling through before the interview, because sometimes I like to see what the latest thing is our guests have been up to. You had mentioned in one of your latest posts that you were with a group of people, including your wife, at the Kettle Moraine State Forest. So do you go on location a lot? So there's one question. And then the second one is, what's at that state forest?
You know, actually, yes, we try to go out as much as possible. For me, that's the real meat and potatoes of investigation. That should be the goal. If you're really interested in this stuff, is to get out and try to experience as much of it as possible. And so the Kettle Moraine State Forest is something that got on our radar a couple of years ago. We I was introduced to our friend Jay Bachochin when I started on the Lake Michigan Mothman stuff. You know, so we both discovered pretty quickly that we were Chicago Bears fans living in southern Wisconsin. So right there, we had a lot to talk about. You know, there was a lot of commiseration happening. We developed this friendship. You know, of course, we're both interested in weird stuff. And so something he would do a lot is he has these research areas throughout the Kettle Moraine State Forest, because there are a lot of weird sighting reports that come from the areas in and around this forest. And so if you're not from Wisconsin, and probably most people aren't, the Kettle Moraine State Forest is huge, and it sort of runs in segments, like from the southeastern portion of Wisconsin, sort of all the way up like its east side, until like the next thing you know, you're all the way up in the Great White North, and you get the really massive forests like Nicolet National Forest. The Kettle Moraine is interesting to me in that it is this sizable forest, right? Or series of forests, really, that abut civilization, you know, because there's these small towns and stuff like all over there, and that's where these sightings come from. Because obviously, like, you know, if a Bigfoot you know, craps in the woods and there's nobody there to see it, like, does it even matter? You know, like, who cares? And so you get these people in these small towns and they'll be out and it's always doing something normal, driving, you know, from point A to point B, just running errands or going to a friend's house or something. And next thing that they know, they're seeing something that they just can't explain, be that Bigfoot or Dog Man or a UFO or a winged humanoid or what have you. And so the Kettle Moraine State Forest is an area known for those types of sightings. And so Jay, for years now, has been going out there and going to like his different research locations that he's chosen based primarily on like witness sightings and stuff. So he's very knowledgeable of that area. And, you know, when I found out that he went out there all the time, I was like, well, can we go? You know, obviously that's my first question. Like, can we go with you? Several years back, he took us out for the first time, and it was very interesting. And so we've been going back at every opportunity since. So we try to get, you know, a good few trips out there every year. It's a relatively weird area. The problem with this field in terms of trying to present people with evidence is that almost all of the evidence we have is experiential. And so I can tell you my experience and that's about it. And then what people do with that, you know, is up to them. And so in terms of things that I've seen out there that are weird, like anomalous balls of light, plenty of those. I've heard weird things that sounded like people talking in a language that I couldn't identify. I've seen a large, it looked to be humanoid shape that crossed the path. You know, maybe a 50 or 100 feet in front of us. One of the anomalous lights was actually captured on camera, which was interesting. Like this would have been, probably 2 years ago now. We were out there. It was me and Emily, of course, and Jay, and then our friend Adam Benedict of the Pine Barrens Institute. And then my niece Allie was out there as well. And so Adam and Allie and I were sort of out in front, and then Jay and Emily had hung back because sometimes we just like to sort of space out like that, and then you've got more eyes in different areas. We're actually heading to the exit because we were about to go home. I'm looking straight ahead, and I see this white light, and it seems to start at the top of the tree line and then move straight down in the trees. And so the reason that I say that it was in the trees is because I remember distinctly this light illuminating the trees behind it. And so it seemed like it dropped straight down and then just disappeared. And so I see this happen, you know, maybe 100, 150 feet away. And, you know, I shouted some kind of expletive and then, you know, was asking if anybody else saw that. And of course, Adam was looking in the wrong direction and my niece was looking the equally wrong direction. But Jay and Emily were looking, you know, it straight ahead, just like I was, and they saw it too. And sure enough, when we went back and looked at Jay's body cam footage, you can see this little light. It's not as impressive on film, but that's, you know, it's a matter of perspective. When you're seeing something in real life, the attention, I think, that your mind automatically pays to it probably makes it more impressive than it really is. And that's sort of the kinds of stuff that we expect to see at this point. And so we'll go out and try to obviously capture as much of that as possible. But also, you know, we've experimented more with trying different means of communication up to and including, you know, like bringing out like a spirit box and the Estes method to communicate with anything there. We tried the CE5 protocols, which was interesting because just following that, we actually did capture some kind of UFO. And when I say UFO, I don't mean like an alien spacecraft. I literally just mean an unidentified flying object. And we captured this UFO that was only visible on IR, which was really, really odd to me. And so, you know, of course, like we're familiar enough to recognize things like insects and dust and everything else that you would expect. But this didn't have any of the characteristics of any of that stuff. It literally just seemed like this light that was moving across the sky and it did some weird maneuvers and then kind of got bright and it disappeared. And the whole thing was very strange. I don't know what we're looking for specifically, because I don't know what's behind any of this. And so a lot of why we keep going back out there is because stuff keeps happening. And if some sort of revelation can be born of that, then great, you know. But until then, I guess we're just trying to experience as much as possible.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored. Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, "But wait, there's more to the story." And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
And what was this humanoid figure that you said you saw?
I ended up having Jay stand where I saw this thing. And, you know, given his height, it had to be probably, you know, right around 7 feet tall, at least from my perspective. I don't know if it was a shadow or if it was just dark, because it was dark out. And a lot of the time, out there, we won't have flashlights on unless absolutely necessary, because in that kind of environment, unless you're trying to look at something very specific, like something in a very specific direction or a specific object, you will probably experience less with your flashlight on than you will with it off. If there's any kind of moon that will, you know, actually provides ambient light, it's usually plenty to, like, once your eyes will adjust to it for you to be able to see pretty well, frankly. I know that I measured after the fact, and I want to say it was actually about 50 feet in front of me on the trail. I was right where the trail started to curve, actually. It was curving to my left. And then there, you know, of course, were trees directly by that area. And I saw what seemed to me to be this huge, you know, bulky, like, humanoid figure. And it took, like, just a couple of steps across the trail and then disappeared into this forest. And, you know, obviously we went up there. I was the only one that saw it. So that right there is already not great. And we went up there and looked at the area, and I didn't see anything disturbed. I didn't see any footprints. You know, I didn't see any branches broken or anything. That's just it. I mean, that's what it looked like I saw.
In the summer of 2017, it sounds like there were a lot of sightings of this Lake Michigan Mothman around Chicago and in Chicago. Sometimes the sightings there would be several of the same, I guess, incident, if you will, and there would be different people who reported the same incident from different vantage points. I found those pretty credible because I think they're definitely seeing something. Their experiences are real in that they had them.
It's interesting that you brought up sort of the similarities between some of those sightings, because what eventually emerged were two different profiles that I had compiled. The first one is really, I was going to say almost certainly, but it's not. It's certainly, like, misidentified birds. You know, it's not the sexy answer. It's not what people want to hear. And I totally get that. I don't think it's our job to just tell people what they want to hear or give, like, the most, you know, salacious possibility or something. It just kind of is what it is, you know, and that accounts for probably a little less than half of these sightings I could comfortably sort of put in into that profile. And it actually came about because in May of 2018, there was a gentleman who was bicycling to work. And it was the middle of the afternoon, this beautiful spring, you know, day. And he's bicycling to work and he's wearing a helmet, and on his helmet, he has his GoPro camera. And as he's bicycling to work, he sees this couple standing on a street corner, and they're clearly looking at something, you know, like the guy's pointing at something in the sky. He looks up, he sees what he later described to me as a either a giant bat or a person in a wingsuit, right? And so, you know, he's blown away, of course, decides that he's going to follow it around and get as much footage of it as he can before he actually has to get to work. And he did. And, you know, he, again, like, he was very, very forthcoming in terms of being a witness. Often, if somebody is intentionally hoaxing something, they're not very cooperative. They might even just send you, like, a one-off story and then you never hear from them again, because most people who, you know, who are full of it know that their story isn't going to stand up to scrutiny. And so they don't really want to talk to you too much. And that was not this guy. He definitely believed that he had seen something. He did see something that was outside of his experience and ability to explain. And so his sighting was very authentic. He even went so far as to mail us the SD card from his GoPro camera, so we could take a look at that footage directly. It obviously was not doctored in any way. And he was very helpful in helping us sort of get some good still of this object he had seen, and then we were able to blow him up, and it was a bird. I mean, 100%, there's no doubt in my mind that what he had seen was a bird, but I think it was probably a very big bird. You know, my guess would be something like a great blue heron. The thing about great blue herons is they look like flying dinosaurs. Not necessarily super common to see them in flight, you know, because very similar to like sandhill cranes. They hunt on the ground, and they have to be, you know, standing on their weird long legs when they do that. And so when they fly, a lot of people aren't really used to seeing that. And the reality is, due to climate change and destruction of their natural wetland habitat, there are more herons roosting in urban areas, like specifically Chicago, than there ever have been. And they're coming up north earlier. They're staying up north longer. They're even overwintering sometimes, which is, you know, not very usual. But it's happening more and more because of these factors. And so you have these birds that look weird as hell when they're flying. There are people who will see something like that and they have no idea what it is. And it looks weird because when they fly, they have these long necks, but they pull their neck back. So their head is you know, kind of sunk into their shoulders. And then they have these long legs that will trail behind them and these huge wings. You know, their wingspan's like 7 feet or so. And so I'm not surprised that people will see something like that and think that it is, you know, paranormal. And so this profile of those particular sightings really came together because of that sighting in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago. It basically involves the sightings where it's daylight, somebody sees something flying that's relatively far away. It's not a very up-close sighting. They don't experience any of the other, like, additional paranormal phenomena that other people will sometimes report. And so there's really nothing unusual about it other than they'll say, oh, I saw this weird thing flying around one afternoon. And then you've got this other profile. And these are the sightings where if you believe the witness's testimony is authentic, and I don't have any reason not to, then the sighting can't be explained by anything like a misidentification. And my approach to investigation when it comes to working with witnesses is to treat their testimony as though it is accurate and authentic, unless and until I have something otherwise. Much like that Pilsen sighting, you know, like when he called me and he was like, I saw a giant bat, or maybe it was a guy in a wingsuit. I didn't say, oh, no, that's stupid. You know, I was like, oh, okay, well, that's really, really interesting. Like, give me all the details of your experience and every bit of supporting, you know, evidence that you have, and let's get to the bottom of this. And so you have this other profile of sightings where when you do that, the pieces don't fall together to get you a misidentified bird. And so those sightings will involve people, you know, seeing something relatively close, humanoid shaped with a large wingspan. They'll often describe things like glowing red eyes or other sort of paranormal aspects. They'll describe a feeling of the eyes feeling like they're penetrating their soul, or that like they're being hypnotized. They will describe a feeling of stark fear. That's not usually present in the misidentified bird sightings. They'll describe being very, very afraid. Sometimes the fear actually starts before the sighting. So they'll be afraid first and then they'll see this thing. And then those sightings too, you know, quite often will either involve like UFOs being seen in the same area, or it'll be in an area where other weird humanoid sightings have come from. Oh, one other paranormal aspect that people sometimes report will be the being sort of mysteriously vanishing. Sometimes people will say that they saw an actual physical portal or something, but much more common, it's just, it was there and then it wasn't. Between those two profiles, you know, I think we've got a pretty good picture of what's happening in terms of people's experiences. And my take on that first profile is that it's important. You know, it's really, really important to be able to explain the things that we can, because why the hell would anybody believe us about the things we can't explain if we're not doing our due diligence and explaining the things that we can?
That brings me to the question I had about the word impossible. And behind me, I have a title to one of your books, Strange Tales of the Impossible. And you also have the tagline, investigate the impossible. I think that's on your Twitter, right? What is it about that word that you get drawn to?
I started using it because I was irritated with the dismissiveness that I would see so often about these experiences that people would have. I mean, you couldn't have seen that. That's impossible. You know, so you have all of these like supposedly impossible experiences that people are still having, whether or not anybody thinks it's possible. They're still having these experiences. And so I use the word sort of tongue in cheek, where it's like, oh, wow, look at all of this impossible stuff people keep experiencing. How weird is that?
How about you? Do you scare easily?
I don't. For anybody who's read Strange Tales, you know, you get through the part where I talk about some of my own experiences, and people will often say, well, you know, like, well, that had to be terrifying. After a certain point in my life, I did stop being afraid. And so my view on that is kind of just, you know, honestly, whatever this is, you know, like whatever is behind any of these seemingly paranormal experiences. And I don't think it's necessarily the same thing, but whatever it is that's behind these individual experiences, if it wanted to hurt people, I think we'd be hurt by now, you know? And so I don't think there's much element of physical danger. I get startled, you know what I mean? Like, and that's impossible to prevent. That's just like an autonomous nervous like reaction. There's nothing you can do about that. If something surprises me, like I definitely get startled, but you know, there's no like weird existential terror or anything for me surrounding this stuff.
Some of the Mothman sightings from Chicago, the Lake Michigan area, sort of reminded me of the original ones from Point Pleasant based on the book, because there were some feelings that you described, like dark fear. They were also accompanied by visitors like the Black-Eyed Children and Indrid Cold in Point Pleasant. There was nothing like that you came across in the Lake Michigan Mothman story?
There wasn't any weird UFO like contactee, you know, narratives or anything that I had come across. Like I had mentioned, there were other like humanoid sightings that took place in sort of the same geographic areas. There are plenty of UFO sightings that took place. I should really start with this, because this will make more sense for people. I resisted using the word Mothman for probably 2 years because I didn't want to sensationalize anything. I didn't want to just apply this Mothman label to get people to go, oh, well, I've heard of that. Like, let me look at this. But at a certain point, the similarities were just too great, and I couldn't ignore them. You know, I just couldn't in good conscience pretend like there was nothing similar happening here. And when you look at Keel's narrative surrounding the Point Pleasant sightings, I think it's fine for him to have speculated and tried to make connections between things. I don't think that he was infallible when he did that. So I think that there's plenty of stuff that you can look at in terms of his speculative investigation and subsequent findings that you could take issue with. Indrid Cold is one of those for me. The Men in Black is one more, where when you read about sort of the Men in Black involvement in that Point Pleasant flap, I mean, I'm kind of a weird nerd. It just sounds like weird nerds who are into UFOs or weird stuff, who heard about this happening. And so they just started going around asking people, what else would you do? It's like 1966, you know, like what else are you going to do? You know? Yeah. Like I didn't necessarily see the exact same things, but I think that's because you're comparing this investigation to John Keel's narrative surrounding things that were happening in Point Pleasant. When if you look at the core phenomenon, if you're just looking at winged humanoid sightings that people reported, like the stuff that actually made the news, like stuff that we have multiple sources on, you know, that stuff is basically the same as what people are reporting all around Lake Michigan now. And everything else was included because, you know, the author felt it was necessary, or there was some connection, but that's his opinion, and it's not necessarily supported by anything you could consider to be objective fact.
In your book, you mentioned the villain from Jeepers Creepers. A lot of the descriptions sound a lot like that villain in Jeepers Creepers. I think there were two of those movies, kind of horror movies from the early 2000s. I also feel like that sort of foreboding like feeling reminded me of the Dementors from Harry Potter. I guess this is more of a cultural question. Do you think those movies or books had any effect on the sightings? Like, do you think these are people who were conditioned to see something like that?
I don't necessarily. My feeling was always, when speaking with these people, that rather than the movie influencing what they had seen, what they were doing was using the movie as a point of reference to describe something completely outside of their experience. And so what you see quite often is people literally don't have the words to describe what they've seen. The most talented writer, I think, to really put into words like their exact experience. And so, you know, when you're asking just some average person who has no experience in trying to, you know, describe these impossible events, they look for, you know, something like some aspect of their culture that they can tie it to say, okay, it was like this. It's not exactly this, but it's like this. And that's as good as I can do in terms of actually describing this thing.
The only thing left that I have is two questions. Have you ever been to the Bridgewater Triangle here in Massachusetts? And if not, would you accept the invite to come here and we could record on site and, you know, get a couple of episodes out of it?
Oh, I would love to do that. I've never been there, but yeah, I would absolutely at some point be interested in visiting it. It's supposed to be a very fascinating area.
You've said a ton of very interesting and thought-provoking, fascinating nuggets, but the most mysterious one is the Chicago Bears thing. I wrote it down. I've got like three question marks.
It's something you're born into. I can't explain it. It even says on my Twitter profile, somehow still a fan of the Chicago Bears. It is what it is.
Well, thank you so much, Tobias, for spending some time with us here today. Where is the best place for our listeners to get your books?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. And if you are interested in checking out what we do, go to singularfortean.com. You can keep up on all of the latest articles and goings on with the society. And if you're interested in purchasing my books, you can find them on Amazon. Or if you want an autographed copy, just go to singularfortean.com/books.